Hi there, my name's Oisin Nunney and welcome to Audio Talks, presented to you by Harman. And in this episode, we're going to dive into one of the most important issues in the music industry today. And I'm very honoured to be chatting with two tireless and brilliant campaigners for diversity, equity and inclusion in the music business. So first up, we have Linda Coogan-Byrne, who is a music, art and culture publicist and consultant, marketing and social media strategist, GEDI and policy specialist, a data-driven storyteller, music and broadcast journalist and author of the excellent forthcoming book, Why Not Her? A Manifesto for Cultural Change. Welcome to the podcast, Linda.
Hello, thanks for having me. Don't know about tireless now. I'm a little bit exhausted here.
It's all relative. But thank you very much. I think you're both tireless anyway. And joining Linda to complete this dynamic duo, we are absolutely delighted to welcome to the podcast Vic Bain, who is an academic and music business research consultant with a focus on diversity and inclusion. She is the former president and board member at the Independent Society of Musicians and founder of the mighty F-List for Music. Welcome to the podcast, Vic.
Oh, thank you very much.
It's great to have you both here. We have some very important things to talk about. But first, before we dive into where we are and where we need to go, I'd love to hear a bit about where you've been, because you both occupy such very distinct roles within the global music industry, particularly with regards to DEI. And I think your journeys can be very informative and inspiring for our listeners. So can you talk a bit about the path which led you to where you are today? And we're going to start with your good self, Linda.
Yeah, my God, it's a long tale. I started off, as many people working in the industry, as a musician and played a lot of different instruments in a lot of different bands, different genres, predominantly folk and trad. And by the time I left school, I took an apprenticeship working as a luthier in Galway with a master luthier named Paul Doyle, which was a lot of fun. And we specialize in Renaissance stringed instruments. And I was put on the harp assembly and harp construction and theory and design, which was just incredible. And I actually now work with the Historical Harp Society of Ireland as well, which is just a kind of a full circle moment. But yeah, so got kind of started in the very practical and musical side of things. And then as the years kind of went on, I just got to know a lot of people in media. And then I kind of went into more business side and behind the scenes as opposed to front and center. And yeah, from there, I'd start working with record labels and management companies and organizations and artists, bands from all different types of genres, from electronic dance music to metal to rock, pop, folk, indie. And yeah, that's probably the last 20, 25 years of my life, since I was 15, 16 anyway. And it's just been nonstop music, art, my life since then.
Oh, I love it. That's a good life right there. And what a diverse spectrum of audio genres and experience right there. That's brilliant. You're walking the walk and talking the talk. So, Linda, that was a great intro. And I'd love to get the same question from yourself, Vic. Talk to us a bit about how you got to where you are today and what inspires you.
Quite a similar path, I think, to Linda, other than, you know, I didn't become a luthier. That's really impressive. But I did start out as a musician. I trained classically, really, because that was sort of primarily what you could do 35 years ago. But I was a bit of a goth, really, into goth and punk and alternative music. So I would turn up to my Bach choir with purple hair and tattoos, which they all thought was very dramatic. I really got into the psytrance rave scene in the 90s. When I was younger, I did a bit of party promoting. And then I joined the London Bulgarian Choir and sang Bulgarian folk music for a long time. It's yes, very diverse.
My mind blew as well, when I found that out.
And yeah, I just love those sounds. And I recorded some albums with a very experimental composer under the name Rapoon. So really wide musical tastes, but it's still very difficult to get going and make your living purely as a musician. So I realized actually my real skills and strengths were in the business side, doing financial management and helping music companies organize themselves. So I started, coming up to 20 years ago, working for the British Academy of Songwriters, Composers and Authors, now known as the Ivors Academy, and I worked my way up to being chief executive there. So I spent many years working purely with songwriters and composers and campaigning to make sure that they had better working conditions. So that was, yeah, kind of the background for my work history in music.
Wow, I love every bit of that, to be honest. And you reminded me of one of my favourite gigs of all time, Le Voix de Bulgare at the Barbican Centre, sometime back in the 90s. I mean, if music has ever come from outer space, I think it's Le Voix de Bulgare. Absolutely beautiful. Wow, again, incredibly diverse, interesting and exciting backstory there. And this kind of brings us to the work that you're both doing around DEI today, which I think is very complementary and, you know, overlaps sometimes indeed. So I'd love to get an idea of, you know, was there a specific moment where a penny dropped or you just thought, right, this is it, I have to do something about this? Or was there a moment that just fired you to write your book, Linda, Why Not Her, and embark on that whole process of research and campaigning and, you know, moving the political needle and really changing the world?
I mean, we can partially blame Vic. Really. It was over lockdown. I mean, if you're a woman in the music industry, first and foremost, it's not a penny drop moment or a, you know, hang on a second, things aren't right. You just know that it isn't. You feel it, you experience it, you live it. But you go on and you continue on anyway. But over COVID, you know, it gave us all a moment to pause because the whole industry stood still, the whole world stood still. So it was definitely that timeline where I started looking at, you know, what could I do? And I just happened to start listening to a lot of different feminist podcasts and activism-based podcasts. And one of them was a seminar with Vic, Alison Venham, and a few other women. And I remember Vic talking about her data research. And I just kind of thought, my God, yeah, there's so much that, you know, I wasn't thinking about that was, you know, was within my access. Because being a music publicist and owning a music PR and marketing company, I had access to so much data across the board, from press clippings to radio plays. So I use this platform called Radio Monitor. It's a paid for platform, and you can see everything from every single time a radio station plays a song across the UK and Ireland, to how many people listen to the song, to, you know, its audience reach, its impressions, what time of the day it's played at, blah, blah, blah. So I just kind of went, well, yeah, I have this tool and I can probably access what radio stations are playing. Not really thinking it would be as dire as it was. So I kind of set off on my own little plan after I listened to that episode of Vic. I'd never met Vic before or been introduced to her other than the seminar that she was on. So I said, right, this is fantastic. So I just started kind of reaching out to different women that I just found inspiring. So that's kind of how me and Vic met. It was like the summer of 2020, and I'd put out the Irish report very soon after because I had access to all this data. And I started looking up the top playlists across Irish radio. I did it with a few countries, but I started with Ireland because obviously that's where I'm from. And the data was terrible. It was just devastating. And I just thought, oh my God, I wonder what it's like in the UK. So I had a look into UK. It was just nearly as bad, but Ireland was terrible. And that's kind of where it all came from. It was just having that moment suddenly in my career to have free space to do something, because I mean, I always knew there was something wrong. You know, I'd stepped away from very large labels that I'd worked with over the years because I wasn't comfortable with representing certain types of artists that were on the label. And I started going into more freelance and more kind of structured work where I worked with people that I wanted to work with, as opposed to having a label client where you have to work with whoever they send, because it was that way for years and years. But I learned so much in that regard. But yeah, it was kind of around that time as well where I just thought, well, you know what? You know, this is an unprecedented moment in history and in my life where I can either do something or rest on my laurels. So I was bored. It was COVID. So started a movement. So the rest is history. That's where it all started.
Absolutely. Linda, I have to say, I'm very much enjoying your book at the moment. We actually see in black and white the result of all your research, those pie charts that analyse the playlists of the radio stations over years and kind of see the progress, or in many cases, the complete lack of any progress that some of these stations are making. So thank you for your boredom during the lockdown. And this research is really, really important. But Vic, coming over to your good self now, could you talk to us a bit about the genesis of the F List? Why did you launch it? And what is it there to improve about the music industry?
Well, the F List, as we know it now, is also was my lockdown project in COVID. Right. But the origin story goes back 4 years before that to 2016. And I was still at the Ivors, and we were coming up to the 60th anniversary of the Ivors. And I was very interested. I had been thinking for a little while. Obviously, I knew I worked in a very male-dominated part of the industry. I'd been at the Ivors for about 8 years at that point, and so I was aware that pretty much everybody I worked with was male. And I thought, you know, actually, I've got access to all of the historical records of the Ivors. I'm going to look back through all of those years and just have a look and see what is the percentage of women winning these awards. So with the help of my daughter, actually, it was her work experience from school. We trawled through 60 years worth of data, and I realized that only 6% of those awards had gone to women over 60 years. In the entire decade of the 1960s, there was something like 135 awards given out, and only one had gone to a woman. She wrote the lyrics to a television theme tune. And nobody had noticed. Nobody had said anything, commented. It was just, you know, in the organization, it was just not up for discussion. But that really shocked me. That really shocked me. When I was asking my board and so on, you know, why was this? Pretty much the answer would come back to me, well, you know, women just aren't as good as men at writing and composing music. They're just not ambitious enough. They don't want it enough. They want to just have children. They don't participate in music education enough. They don't like playing whatever it is, you know, electric guitars or play the drums. They don't like music technology. It was all blame the women. To my soul, I knew that wasn't true. So a few years later, I suffered very bad health. I had breast cancer. And in that period of my treatment, I decided I wanted to leave and follow what had by then felt like my true calling. And that was researching and campaigning for women in music. So I decided I wanted to do a PhD and follow my heart. So I then set about trying to figure out how many women were being supported in music publishing companies. Because the thing about the Ivors being a songwriting award is that the music publishers make the submissions. So I was very interested to know how many women the music publishing companies in the UK were supporting, who was on their roster. So I had a four-month window where I could really delve into this. And then, in fact, I expanded it to look at record labels as well. So music publishing companies and record labels, to discover that only 14% of music publishing rosters were women and 20% of artists and musicians at record labels. I published that research at the end of 2019. It's called Counting the Music Industry. And caused a bit of a kerfuffle, I have to say, in the music industry. It was published in Music Week. And I think people were surprised that it was that bad. I mean, we all knew it was going to be fairly male-dominated, but I think people thought we were a bit further on than we were. And then I set about trying to, I extracted all of the women who I'd found in that research. In the data and the spreadsheets I had, I extracted all of the women I could find, and I published that as a Google spreadsheet online so that festival bookers knew where to find women to book for their festivals. And a BBC music journalist found it, did a story about it. It all went crazy. The headline was, "Festivals have no more excuses now. They know where they can go to book women." And then the pandemic struck. And all of the festivals were cancelled anyway. So I was, like we all were, like you sat at home going, what do I do now? And then I decided to make the F-List a directory that women could create their own listings and put their own assets up. So now we have over 6,200 listings in the directory. And it's, it just sort of grew. Organically, it grew during the pandemic.
Amazing. My God, there's an origin story. I love the way that your stories overlap. And I think it's very informative how obviously both of you from your lived experience and also from working in the industry knew how bad things were. But it took that moment of crystallization and looking at the data to just see it black and white in your face, this is undeniably something structural. I really applaud the work that you're both doing and have done to kind of zero in on the actual facts of this issue, and you're pushing the needle, both of you, to change it for the better. But like, once you started looking into the data and looking into the industry that you both worked in, did it give you some kind of a flavor on how broken the music industry is?
I mean,
yes, right.
It's, I mean, I think there's something that that has to be addressed with even just venturing into the things that myself and Vic ventured into.
Yeah.
Like, it comes with a lot of slack, you know, it comes with a lot of industry disdain, because when you call something out in an industry that is quite happy and content as they are, and the work that you do might economically shift that industry in terms of sharing more of the pie, it's not very welcomed, you know. So there's a lot at stake when you do that. So it's not just as willy-nilly as, oh, we were bored, so we just did this. There was a lot of thought that had to go into making this such a big decision, especially being an aware, intelligent person that is completely kind of open to the understanding that when you do put something of this magnitude out into the world, whether it's a data research, a report, a study, that it can have completely and utterly devastating repercussions on your professional career, on your personal career, on your mental health. And I think that's something that not a lot of activists really talk about, or campaigners, because, I mean, I was economically disadvantaged. I had to leave Ireland. I had to go and, you know, travel elsewhere, you know, tap into savings that I'd had. And, you know, it was because work was taken from me. People were like, you know, don't work with her, she's asking questions. So there is a lot of, while it's kind of merry and happy and great and grand, there is a very dark side of activism. And I think it would be remiss to just leave that out of the equation. Yeah. I don't know what Vic's experience is as such, where with that. But I mean, I had websites hacked. I had social media platforms taken down, you know, death threats, rape threats. Like, I mean, you know, altercations on the street with some people, you know, it was just ridiculous. And as a female in the industry, you are prone and susceptible to certain types of abuse that men just wouldn't receive. So, yeah, I think that has to be factored in into this whole thing just from the get-go. Because, as I say in the book, Why Not Her? A Manifesto for Culture Change, which is out on April the 11th, at the end of it, I have a kind of a workbook segment. And in the workbook segment, I have a little thing after every single part where it's like, this is what you have to do and this is what you can do. We have a little reality check space, because it's like, look, having a calling is both a good thing and it's a cross that you have to carry, because it doesn't come without its cautionary tales and without its negative experiences. So I have that in the book, and it's something that is a really important thing, because it's not just, you know, let's go out there and let's change the system. There's a lot of backlash that comes with that. So I just wanted to highlight that and to mark it before we step further. Now over to you, Vic.
Oh, thank you, Linda.
Well, yeah, very similar. You know, I had to step out of the industry in order to do this work, because I had become increasingly vocal inside the industry, and I was very explicitly told to stop it and tone it down, and I was upsetting people and so on. So I knew I had to sort of step outside and be independent in order to have the freedom to do this work, this research, and to be able to speak out freely. But I definitely was removed from a lot of people's Christmas card lists. Especially after Counting the Music Industry was published. And I had had meetings with quite a number of senior men in the industry who run very high profile companies. So I gave them a preview of the statistics and said, Louis, I'd love to work with you, love to come to your board or do some work, and we can own these statistics together. And, you know, you can be alongside me and say, this is awful, but we're going to work together and change it. And not one person took up that offer. I was told things
tumbleweed.
Like... tumbleweed. I was told things like, but we did diversity last year.
Oh, Jesus.
And, we had that one clinic there three years ago yesterday.
And then, you know, and quite a number of those people who I had meetings with then no longer answered any of my communications. I mean, ever again.
Damn.
So it, it definitely doesn't make you popular.
Now, totally.
So I do have to say, you know, there are amazing companies who do want to do work and who have reached out, and I've worked with them since. So I don't want to say that that's everybody. There are definitely people in the music industry who do want to change, who do want to do better. And I've done, you know, various projects and things with, and that's wonderful. We have to change the industry. I mean, literally one person at a time. So that gives me hope. That keeps me going. But no, it certainly wasn't for my financial security, shall we say, that I'm doing this work. I mean, I'm self-funding my PhD. I'm only working part-time anyway because I'm doing all of this research, for which nobody pays me. So it is a real personal sacrifice, but I've just got to keep doing this work. I'm just compelled, like Linda, compelled to do it.
Yeah. And even sometimes, Oisin, like sometimes when they're being mean, they're also nice about it. You know, there was a letter that I got, I swear to God. And it started like, you know, hi, Linda, just giving you an anonymous heads up and advice as a friend. What? Everyone in the industry has been talking about you and the activity around increased airplay for female artists. Yes, your views and opinions on this matter are correct. And it's great to see and I admire you for it. However, this is a flip side. However, having said that, you are stepping on people's toes and it's gotten to the stage where enough is enough. The word is that if you keep stepping on people's toes and it is pushing into the stages where music directors, radio stations and other outlets are going to blacklist you, and this will result in your clients receiving no airplay or coverage. Speaking to a lot of the DJs and jocks, they have heard enough about all of this. Now, this is just a friendly heads up, as I admire you for this, but I also do want to just not get involved either. Take what you want from this, but as I said, this is just a friendly heads up. Now, I got so many of these types of emails, of texts, of calls. So even when they're being mean, they're trying to be nice about it. So there are nice, mean people at the end. and then there's just, you know, obviously there's good people as well. I mean,
yeah,
it's not everyone it's probably 99.9%, but there is yeah. 1%.
There is light at the end of the tunnel somewhere. Yeah. Oh, listen, thank you both for everything you're doing, because my goodness, you've both made a lot of personal sacrifices and you're coming up against this ingrained systemic resistance, excuses, you know, dismissing voices, belittling voices, trying to minimize the issue. It personally drives me completely nuts. So I appreciate what you're doing very much indeed. Do you think that this absolutely broken music industry with this kind of resistance, these kind of prejudices and barriers in place and have been for a very long time, the data is unarguable, it's beyond any doubt. Do you think this reflects a broken society in a way? Is this a reflection of a bigger issue?
It definitely is a societal-wide issue. There are very deeply ingrained gender roles that are put on us, which will pretty much dictate the sorts of job roles we go into and how we're compensated for them, or sort of dictate the type of responsibilities that you have in your domestic private life as well. So this is in all sectors, no matter what sector we work in, but in music, it sort of manifests in men being encouraged and being supported into being professional musicians, to being able to go on tour, to have very highly paid music tech roles as producers and engineers, or, you know, men who are supported in being A&Rs, then they have that pathway up into being CEOs in organizations. And they are the higher paid, higher status roles. Whereas women are sort of funneled off or encouraged to do music teaching, music therapy, marketing, HR roles, all of these, you know, people roles. And it's not to say that men and women shouldn't be doing those roles, but if that's the only thing you can do, then it is limiting. And the roles that women are encouraged to do are not as well rewarded. So we need to ensure that we are all able to do whatever we want and encouraged to do whatever we want. And never mind then thinking about, well, who is at home looking after the kids or the elderly parents while you're trying to balance those jobs as well. So yes, it is a societal thing.
Wow. Yeah. I mean, as you're talking there, I'm just remembering that like some of the best A&R people I've worked with have been women. On the music side, Teresa Ensenat, who worked for Geffen and A&M, who's absolutely incredible. On the publishing side, Alison Donald, who's just magnificent. But I know that their stories are not without a lot of personal struggle, and they really did have to break through these glass ceilings of prejudice to get where they are today. But Linda, I'd like to come over to yourself, just following up from what Vic said, because she was talking about these kind of ingrained gender expectations and roles in society. And in your book, you speak about the wonderful liberating potential of breaking through these kind of narrow expectations and gender roles. Do we think if we had a more equitable and inclusive music industry, this could play a role in healing this broken society?
I mean, totally. But the thing is, as Vic was saying there, the music industry is a microcosm of everything else, from politics, media, tech, education. Everything is just a mirror. And the same way women are sidelined at festivals and playlists, the same in courtrooms, in the workplaces, harassed online, in politics. And the music industry, the bias takes a, I suppose, in one way, a bigger, sharper edge, because the music industry is so focused on, especially like the fame side of it. Obviously, different genres of music have different elements to it, but, you know, pop, mainstream music, women that are touring are constantly asked, you know, oh, what's it like being a mother and, you know, having the kids? I mean, as a publicist, I remember being in many situations where women are asked the most ridiculous questions about their appearance. Like, say, I worked with Alison Moyet a number of years ago, and I remember booking her onto a TV show in Ireland, and big TV show. And behind the stage, I said to the producer, look, don't talk about weight. Do not talk about the fact that Alison lost weight, because it was the thing that everybody was asking her. Well, nothing got to do with her new music or her career, anything, all her accolades, her awards, her fantastic career to date. But people were transfixed on the fact that she lost a little bit of weight. And even with women, even women producers, presenters, they still went there. And for anyone that I worked with that was female and had children, no matter how big they were, in a studio with a DJ, they'll go, oh, sure, how are the kids back at home? How are you managing this? That doesn't happen. You won't hear, how do you juggle fatherhood while being on the road? How do you do it? You know what I mean? Because that expectation isn't there. But on women, it is. And it's like in the book, I highlight this near the end, and I talk about Nina Simone and the Nina Simone effect. It's like women can be one thing or another thing. For some reason, they can't be everything. You can't be a mother and be this amazing support to your children and the family, and then be going out and being a, you know, an activist, a campaigner or a leader or a CEO. It's kind of like, oh, whoa, how can you be a good mother if you're also this? But I mean, men do it. But it's never questioned, it's never asked. So definitely a woman's worth or a woman's place is considerably questioned if they're a parent, if they have children, if they're a guardian to anybody. It's no longer just about their career. So, yeah, I mean, the system is a microcosm of everything. It's just a double standard, really.
You just reminded me there of a previous recording of the podcast that we did with the wonderful ladies at Sound Girls. And we had some really, you know, high end, some of the best mix engineers and live sound engineers in the business. And one of them, Michelle Pettinato, was on the podcast, and she spoke about, I think, the first time she was going and doing the front of house sound for one of the preeminent stadium bands in America, absolutely massive. And a colleague of hers that she hadn't worked with before from the crew asked her which member of the band she was with. It was assumed that she was with a member of the band because she was a woman behind the mixing desk.
Of course.
Just crackers. Yeah. So Vic, coming over to yourself, your report on counting the music industry, it reveals some really shocking, but perhaps not unexpected stats about the business. Could you take us through some of those findings? And I'd love to get your perspective on how they might point to systemic barriers in the industry.
Pretty much all music companies publish their rosters online. These are the window shop fronts for all of the music companies. And actually, I couldn't believe that nobody had thought about looking at them before. So I went to the websites of over 100 music publishing companies and literally just copied the data. Sometimes I was able to scrape, sometimes I had to type it all by hand and looking at the composers of works which were in copyright as well, not historical. I wasn't counting the Mozarts and the Beethovens. I was looking at living composers and seeing that only 14% of these rosters were women. And then I thought, well, I can't just do the publishing companies and not look at the record labels. So I did the same, over 200 of those, and seeing that only 20% of the artists signed to record labels were women. And there was a little bit of difference actually in the labels between solo artists and members of bands. So if we separated out the solo artists, overall it was 25% were women and 15% of band members. This was across genres. And I also explore genre differences in the report. If anyone's interested, you can download it for free. Just Google Counting the Music Industry. And then I thought, goodness me, I really need to start talking about why this is. One of the things I was told was that women don't participate in music education in the same numbers. And this was someone who was teaching at a university teaching music. And I said, really? So then I've tried actually getting information from individual universities and wasn't getting anywhere. Then I discovered that there is a department of the Office of National Statistics called the Higher Education Statistics Authority. And I could get the data from them on all music students. So I got the data for a five-year period between 2013 and 2018. There was 120,000 people studying music at UK universities. And I crunched the data. I was so excited. Linda will totally understand this. When you get the data, it was like Christmas.
It's like excitement, depression. It's an emotional roller coaster, Roisin.
Analyzing by gender, analyzing the data of who was studying what type of music degrees. Now, overall, it was about 44% across all music topics. If you narrow it down, if you sort of look at the audio music degrees, it's far fewer women in those types of degrees that are indicating a bottleneck before we get to university. But for music performance, it was 49%.
Wow.
So the fact I was being told, well, you know, it's women aren't participating in music education, that's absolutely not true at all. We certainly know that from sort of GCSE and A-level data as well. In fact, it's more young girls are studying music than young boys. So that filtering sort of starts at university level. And then, so there's just as many young women who are graduating with music for performance degrees at that point, who are just as good as the young men, but they don't have the same performance opportunities. So data is so important.
But they'll still deflect it, though.
That's it. I like a note that you made in your book, Linda, which was about when you were speaking to a gentleman who was in the music industry, and he seemed to be slightly less than receptive to the raw data, the facts in his face. And then you started asking him about his daughter. Yeah. And suddenly he kind of melted a bit, and there was that light bulb moment where he joined the dots.
Putting a face on the data, and that's it. Because I know these people. I mean, I'm working in this industry for 2 decades, you know, it was just, Linda, you know, men make better music than women, and Jesus, all this, why are you feeding us to the wolves? And it's not our fault, it's the labels. It was just deflection, deflection, deflection. And then I just thought, well, Jesus, what am I going to do? So we launched this campaign, and we did like a call to action, because we start getting loads and loads of support. It was brilliant within kind of going into the second year, and especially after the UK report blew up, because we had Becky Hill and Camille and Dua Lipa, but we had all these massive female artists talking about it, a little mix. So it was really, really big. It was a lot bigger than the Irish one ever went. It was just huge. And just like, what do we do? So we just start kind of getting people to upload videos or images of like holding a banner, like, you know, hashtag why not her. And there was these massive collages that we made, and we didn't really need it as much in the UK, but we got really big UK artists to send in photos and that. And then the Irish artists, like the grassroots and the indie male artists, start getting in touch, like Conor O'Brien and Damien Dempsey, and just amazing guys.
Absolutely.
Saying, you know, look at what can we do? Ronan O'Snodig from Keela and that. And I said, well, send me in a photo, you know. I said, come on, show your solidarity, yes. Literally.
Excellent.
So, not a dicky bird from any of the major commercial pop artists. If anything, it was like, are you sure you're allowed to release this data kind of thing, you know? And it was just one of these things where when I put the human side to it and said, well, look, have you got a sister or a wife, a mother, a daughter? And then those that did have a daughter were kind of like, all right. And I said, well, what if your daughter grew up and she wanted to be a drummer or bass player? Heaven forbid, a lead singer with a band. What if it's a rock band? Jesus, that's a really big issue. Like, she's never going to be taken serious. And it was just, oh, right, yeah. And it was still kind of, yeah, that's terrible. But there still wasn't so much change. So what I did then was I thought, well, look it. What if you just start playing women on the overnight playlist? Even any type of airtime would be helpful. So this was like a brilliant idea. Oh, jeez, yeah, we can do that. We can absolutely do that. Yeah, we'll do that. So we start to see this massive shift from national radio and commercial and regional radio in Ireland, where women and people of colour were being played between the hours of 12, 1 o'clock a.m. to 5 a.m., 6 a.m. And this was them like, hey, we're diverse.
Yeah, it's like with both your initiatives, with the F-List and with your book and with Why Not Her, it's like when you see it in the world, you think, of course, it's about time, it's over time, here we go, let's make it happen. But, you know, what I'm hearing loud and clear from both of you is that it's always a work in progress. There's so much more work to do and we really do need everyone to get on board. So speaking of which, Vic, I would love for you to share, if anybody wants to get involved in the F-List, how would they go about it?
Well, they can send me a message via the website. There's a contact page on the website or any of our social media platforms. So F-List Music on Instagram, Blue Sky. Love to hear from people. We have F-List ambassadors. We've got various programs and projects. We've got funding to run for that people can apply to. And they can create a listing as well and join the community.
I love the way you say that so gently. We have disruptors. We have Why Not Her disruptors.
Oh, fantastic. So Linda, you had some great names there, like Damien Dempsey, you know, some absolute true shining stars. If people are listening and they're inspired and they want to get involved in the campaign, A, they should get your book, Why Not Her, when it comes out. And we will, of course, link to both of your websites and the book and the study in the show notes, of course. But Linda, where would you direct people if they want to support your work?
Why Not Her, just whynother.eu, and right, there's a volunteer link. If you have a background in data research, if you have a background in data analysis, it's an absolute must. But if you do, and you're interested in volunteer, because we're, everything that we do is unfunded, every single thing. We've never been funded once. We never made a penny since 2019 up until now. It's just people-powered campaign. There's no red tape. If you can't do this and you can't do that, it's like, no, publish the facts, publish the data. You just have to be a badass. You just have to not be afraid to be cancelled, yes, because my Jesus Christ, they will try to cancel you. Yeah. So resilience is a must. Resilience is a must.
Well said. Well said. And that's coming through loud and clear from both of your stories there. You're not getting paid by any company to do this. You're doing the work just to make the world a better place. And that is the highest calling possible. But Vic, coming over to yourself, I mean, I know you've got an amazing background in academia. How important do you think education can be as a tool to transform the world, you know, to educate the musicians and music industry professionals of the future?
I'm an academic now, but, you know, I stepped out of the business. I was nearly 50. And to go back to school, I don't know if it's feckless, but it was, you know, it was just a calling. Having spent 5.5 years back in academia now, has been great. I've learned so much. I love learning. I've discovered it's one of my core values. We have to keep studying and learning, and some of us can do that outside of academia, of course. But I've really enjoyed going back to school and really delving into very deep questions of not just what we're seeing, you know, in terms of statistics, but understanding why, understanding the mechanisms and processes as well. So it's just purely for my own entertainment, really. But if I can do some good along the way out of that learning, then all the better.
Fantastic. So the answer is, it's data, it's storytelling, it's education, it's community, it's the power of coming together to make the world a better place. That is fantastic. And let's look at what kind of magic can happen when this actually works, when it all comes together. You mentioned Jazzy, you mentioned Ray earlier, Linda. What would you like to say in terms of the world we should be living in and the huge success that can come to everybody when the music industry gets it right?
I think it's just about awareness. I mean, just even going back to the academic and the teaching and the learning and the sharing knowledge. I mean, we need to teach people, students, people in the industry that, and especially young men and boys, that equity and equality is not a threat. It is not a threat to their masculinity. It is not a threat to your manhood. Music is a cultural language. Art is a cultural language. And, you know, if you train people to only speak one dialect, you kill innovation. So if you want to progress and if you want to see the world as it is, as opposed to just how it has been shaped to be, there's no room for growth. There's no room for innovation. So educators and people in power and people in leadership need to ask, who are you citing? Who are you referencing? Who are you excluding? And if we don't do that, if we don't take all of this data and all of this work and all of this research and put it into practice, and if people that we're providing it for don't put it into practice, it's going to be a big issue. Because what we see is, look at CMAT, look at Ray in the UK, CMAT in Ireland, Jazzy in Ireland. When women and gender diverse and, you know, diverse artists in general are given an opportunity, they absolutely thrive. These aren't anomalies. They're made anomalies because of the repression behind the status quo. So education and reach and talking, conversations, you know, sharing data, talking about it. Because as Vic has brought up earlier on, there's a lot of opinions going around. But it's not to lead with, oh, women can't make music or women can't do that. That's not true. Women don't study music. Yes, they do, actually. There's nearly 50% of women go to college and learn practically as a core. So a lot of the time when you're mansplained or you're told something, it's like, well, hang on, have you got the academic qualifications and the skill set to actually argue this data set? And a lot of the time, they do anyway. But yet they ridicule you and say, oh, well, it's a woman speaking, so should we even make this viable? So yeah, I think education, the pen is mightier than the sword, it always has been. And when it's the other way around, it only suits one demographic, and that is white men.
Absolutely. Right. Thank you very much, Linda. This is brilliant stuff. And Vic, I'd love to come over to yourself, maybe to get an idea of where we think this could all go in the future. I mean, in a perfect world, if the data is listened to, if we transform the industry, if we all become part of the solution rather than part of the problem, as quite a few people may be unwittingly at the moment, even, you know, where do you think this could go? What is the music industry you'd like to see maybe in 5 years' time?
Wow, I'd love to go to a music festival in any genre of music and see an equal number of men and women up on stage, and for it to be so normal that people don't even comment about it. It's just expected, where the people up on stage reflect the fans, reflect the audiences. So that's my dream.
That's beautiful. Well, if you ever find yourself at Primavera Sound in Barcelona, that is my favourite music festival ever of all time. The lineup is always exemplary. It is wall-to-wall excellence, and it is an equal gender balance. And they've been doing this for years and years. We actually had Marta Olivares Pelleres from Primavera Sound on the previous edition of the podcast. And my goodness, the motivation behind making that excellence is just very inspiring, and it is the best music festival on the planet, in my humble opinion. So yes, that's a glimpse of the future right there. So listen, I'm afraid we are coming up to the end of time, but I do have one more very important question to ask you both, and this is something that we ask all of our VIP guests, and that is to choose a track for our VIP title playlist. And we are going to come to your good self first, Linda.
Oh God, I've been back and forth with this. Like, but I had to make a little last minute change. You're probably going to kill me. Winnie Ama is on our, she's a data analyst, but she's also an incredible, she was just at South by Southwest, and she's played Glastonbury, and she's just absolutely amazing. She's from Belfast, and she has a new track called Fever out, and it's just absolutely fantastic. The music video is beautiful and sassy and just so radio friendly. It ticks every box, pop music and dance music. And Fever is what I would go with, by Winnie Ama.
Fantastic. I love reading about Winnie in your book as well. That's a great story.
She's a data analyst with Why Not Horror. She's brilliant. She's absolutely brilliant.
I'm so looking forward to listening to that piece of music. Thank you, Linda. And coming over to your good self, Vic, what track would you like to add to our playlist?
Again, it's hard, isn't it? There's so many amazing women out there. But I think the track I've been playing a lot since it was released is Little Sims Gorilla. Just because it's so joyous, it's so upbeat. It's about this woman really claiming her talent and her strength and coming into her own as a virtuosic music artist. I love it. It just makes me so happy every time I play it. So I put it on repeat a lot.
Oh my goodness, what an excellent choice there. Those are two brilliant artists and yeah, huge fan of Little Sims. My own contribution to the playlist this episode is slightly on theme, and this is from the album An Encyclopedia of Patriarchy Incomplete by the artist B of Briz, and the track is called Man at the Party, and the two closing lines of this track are just gorgeous. She says, "We didn't build this city alone, we built it together. The best of what we leave behind will be here forever." So listen, it's been an inspiring conversation. Thanks so much for joining us, Linda.
Thank you. Thanks a million for having me. Good Amila Margaret.
Thanks so much for joining us, Vic.
Thank you very much. Yeah, lots of fun.
Listeners, don't forget to subscribe, comment and share Audio Talks with your friends and family. If you're enjoying the Audio Talks series of podcasts, why not pop over to Apple Podcasts, Spotify or wherever you get your favourite podcasts and leave a nice review. It really does mean a lot and it helps new listeners to get to know about the magnificent guests we talk to in every episode, like Vic and Linda. For more exclusive content, some behind the scenes goodies and maybe even some competitions, connect with us over on the Instagram. You can find us at Audio Talks Podcast. We'll be back soon for more inspiring audio talks. See you next time.